Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And hey, if you like the podcast and you like the whole podcast network, and if you like everything that 1517 is doing, you could also become a contributor. I don't mean like you're going to make a podcast and send it over and then get on the network. I mean that you can whip out that debit card and become a contributor that way, because everything that we do is listener supported. So if you're able and you are willing, we would love to have you come and be a contributor. We like keeping everything free. We don't charge anybody for anything. And the reason we're able to do that is because other people are willing to chip in. If you are able to do that, we would appreciate it. Chad, we left David in a spot where he's anointed king over Judah. Got some tension because a military leader has named one of Saul's kids king, and there's a little bit of conflict. We saw some war games go sideways and result in some bloodshed, and we sort of left in this sort of ominous place where it just says that David and Saul's son are fighting with each other. At least their followers are fighting with each other all the time. Meanwhile, while that's going on, David's just having lots of kids from lots of different women. And we mentioned how this is setting up a problem for succession later.
Yeah, we kind of left off. David's been wife collecting.
Yeah, it's like his guys are out there fighting with Saul's guys, and he's just having kids.
Like, you know what? You know what I need? Another wife.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had one, then I had two, then I had three. And then by the time you get to 2 Samuel 3, verse 5, we find out, hey, he's actually got six so far. And he's missing one, which will actually, Michal, which we've heard about before, that's the daughter of Saul. And he's going to get her back in this particular chapter. And that's going to actually kind of foreshadow some bigger problems down the road. Yeah, there's a lot in the rest of the chapter that actually has to do with disagreements over women and wives and accusations about relationships between men and women. And, you know, it's kind of interesting in this chapter because the dominant figure who emerges here is not really David. It's not Joab, who is the commander of David's army. And it's not Saul's son, who has been proclaimed king, Ish-bosheth. The dominant figure in this particular chapter is Abner. So we've heard a lot about Abner over the course of 1 Samuel and then, of course, into 2 Samuel as well. Abner is the cousin of Saul. Their dads were brothers. And Abner was part of Saul's army from way back. We know that already in the David and Goliath episode. But where he emerges here is he turns out that he's more than just a general in the army of Israel. He is like the guy. He's the one with the power. He's the one with not just the military power, but he's also one with persuasive power. He's the one who's actually the one behind the throne, who's putting forward this kind of puppet king, Ish-bosheth, but he's calling the shots, more or less. And what we're going to encounter right away is that in the midst of this kind of strong man, weak king situation, that the king is going to make an accusation that ends up just basically ruining his chance of ever remaining king over the people of Israel. You know, if you've got a guy who's, and you know, he's really the powerful one, Abner, and you know the one he's calling the shots, probably it'd be a bad idea to accuse him of something, but that's what Ish-bosheth does. So we start out here with kind of a general statement that sets the stage for what's going to happen in verse 7 and following. So verse 6 says, it came about that while there was war between the house of Saul, so the northern kingdom, and the house of David, the kingdom of Judah, that Abner was making himself strong in the house of Saul. So that kind of, you know, that cues you in on what Abner's been doing. Now, we don't know enough about his ambitions to know whether he was actually kind of manipulating the situation to put himself on the throne. You would think that if he actually wanted that, then, you know, he would have done that right away because he had all the power. But he does seem, because of what's about to happen, he does seem to have some royal ambitions. And this shows itself in at least what he's accused of. So here's verse 7 and following. I'll just kind of read through this accusation and then the exchange that happens between these guys. Now, Saul, of course, Saul's dead by this time, but Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" Then Abner was very angry over the words of Ishbosheth and said, I love this insult, by the way, "Am I a dog's head?" We need to bring that back, by the way. "Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show kindness," that's chesed, or one of our favorite Hebrew words, "today I show kindness to the house of Saul, your father, to his brothers, and to his friends, and have not delivered you into the hands of David. And yet today you charge me with a guilt concerning the woman." And then he goes on, "May God do so to Abner, and more so, if, as the Lord has sworn to David, I do not accomplish this for him, to transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul and to establish the throne of David over Israel and over Judah, from Dan even to Beersheba." And then we have this closing statement. And he could not answer Abner a word because he was afraid of him.
That escalated fast.
It did. Yeah, that escalated really fast. So we know, we've talked about this before, actually way back in Genesis, that, and we'll see it again in 1 Kings, that when you have a person who's maybe a son of the king or part of the family, when they make a move to either claim the throne, claim power, claim prominence, they're making a power move, in other words. One of the things that they sometimes do is they will either take the wife or the concubine of either the current leader or the dead leader, and by this sexual act also make this kind of power move to set themselves up as either the leader, the king, or at least the next in line. And we saw this back in Genesis with the concubine of Judah, and one of the sons went into this concubine, the eldest son went into this concubine, as a way of kind of setting himself up as the legitimate heir, I suppose we would say, after Judah was gone. And we're going to see this in 1 Kings, in the first couple chapters of 1 Kings, where David's dying, and as we talked about last time, he got all these kids, all these sons. Who's going to be the heir? And one of the guys by the name of, one of the sons, a guy named Adonijah, he takes the concubine, Abishag, wants the concubine of his father David, that young virgin who had kept David warm in bed in his latter years. So Adonijah is making a move to kind of claim the throne for himself by taking the concubine that belonged to his father. So that's another case. And then we'll see another episode of this later in 2 Samuel when Absalom, the son of David, stages the coup. What's the prominent public act that he does? Well, he sets up a tent on the roof of the king's palace, and he brings all of his father's, David's, concubines, his harem, basically, into the tent, and he has sex with them. So this is, it's a power move, but it's a power move that's established sexually. It's basically his way of saying, listen, I'm the new leader. I'm the new king. So all that kind of is a background to this accusation about Abner. So if Abner, and again, this is just an accusation, we really don't know if it's true or not. There's no indication that it's true or false. It's just an accusation. But if it is true, then what Abner was doing, intended or otherwise, was to try and take Saul's concubine as his own and thereby set himself up as the true heir to his cousin's throne.
Well, the other option, of course, is that this is not true and Saul's son doesn't like how much influence Abner has. And so this is also a good thing to make up that somebody did if you were trying to tarnish them to other people. Like, so that you could make this sort of thing up, tell everyone else, like, hey, this guy's trying to do exactly what you just explained. We don't have a way of knowing. It does seem that Abner's pretty insulted by it.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah, whether his reaction is, you know, partly farce, you know, he just kind of acting more outraged than he actually is or not, he certainly comes across that way. So again, we don't have to steer false, but I, judging by his reaction and judging by the power that he already had, I lean more towards seeing this as, you know, maybe Ishibosheth thought it was true, but I honestly doubt whether it is true. Because, yeah, I mean, if Abner wanted the throne, all he had to do was stage a coup and he's got it.
Yeah.
You know, he could easily convince people, listen, I was with Saul this whole time. I was his general. I have the experience. I have the family connections. So set me up as the king. If he'd wanted to do that, well, then nothing would have stopped him from doing that.
And what he's going to do next, you definitely don't do if you want the throne.
Yeah, you don't say, well, I'm going to make David king.
Yeah, that's not a good plan if you're trying to get the throne.
Yeah, so whether it was true or not, and maybe, you know, Ishbosheth is like his dad, and so he had this phobia that everybody was against him. And maybe his son kind of inherited that tendency. He's always thinking, oh, well, you know, now Abner's out to get me. Maybe somebody else is out to get me as well. And anyway, he acts on that by making this accusation. Well, we see the results of this. Abner responds angrily and yes, uses this great insult, am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? And then goes on to say, well, I'll tell you what, I did all this stuff for your dad. I was faithful to him and established him, and I've been protecting you, but all that's over.
Yeah, well,
you make this organization and it's over.
Yeah, it kind of seems that Abner maybe thinks that because he was loyal to Saul, and he is you know, Ishbosheth doesn't seem like the strongest of leaders, and Abner seems like the kind of guy that might find that irritating. And might think that the apple fell a little far from the tree in this scenario. And so his loyalty to Saul, he's going to make Saul's, you know, kid king. But if in fact he didn't do this thing, and then this weakling son is going to come and accuse him of this, that might just been it for him. This isn't going to work. Like, you're not your dad. Oh, you're only like your dad in the worst way, because you see that he's afraid of Abner too. If this was true, and he was a strong leader and going to be a good king, he wouldn't back down if this was true or be afraid. He would say, "Look, dude, like, you did this thing. This is this is straight out of bounds. You can't do this." But he's not, and so it seems that this is a little bit of reading in, but I get the impression that Abner is kind of a little disgusted with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too. Yeah, he seems to have no respect for him as a person.
Yes.
Maybe as respect as, you know, the office that he holds. But as far as a person goes, yeah, he's kind of spineless, you know, easily dominated by Abner. So you can certainly see, after serving Saul all those years, and now you got his son who's just, you know, almost the exact opposite of Saul, that he's like, you know, this is not going to work.
He probably knows, like, dude, if I had slept with your father's concubine while he was alive, like, I'd be dead. What do you think Saul would do to somebody who did this?
Right. Yeah, it'd be definitely be over.
It'd be over, right? And so, yeah, this is a very different kind of person he's dealing with here.
You know, and I will, not in defense of Abner, but just to speak well of Abner, if you look at all of 2 Samuel 3, so this entire chapter and everything that unfolds after it, Abner comes across as a pretty legit kind of guy. In fact, there's not a lot of talk about God in this chapter, but when there is talk about God, it's always Abner. So Abner's the one who's talking about, in this particular case, you know, he's swearing this oath, he's using God's name, and later he's going to talk about how God has anointed David to be the heir over all of Israel. So he's using the Lord's name in a positive way, whereas everybody else, there's just not a whole lot of talk of who God is. So I think Abner, maybe this was the kind of unexpected event that led him to realize, kind of God got through to him, as it were, to point out to the fact that, listen, you should never have anointed Ishbosheth king because David is the one that I have chosen.
Yeah.
So, well, what happens? Well, Abner, I mean, he's not wishy-washy. He's made his decision. So immediately, verse 12, he acts. He says he sends messengers to David. And here's what he says. Whose is the land? The kind of rhetorical question. Yours, more or less. Whose is the land? Well, it's going to be yours. Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring all Israel over to you. Well, that tells you right there the power that Abner has. He's saying, listen, I've got enough sway that I'm going to bring the entirety of Israel over to you. And he's saying, the land belongs to you. You are the legitimate king. But he's wanting to, of course, cement this by means of a covenant. He wants to make sure that this is not just kind of a gentleman's agreement, but they actually swear a covenant with one another. Because, of course, he knows that his life could be in danger if David decides to act against him. So he puts forward the proposal, verse 12. And then David responds positively. I mean, this is, you couldn't receive better news if you're David. This is perfect. He's like, verse 13 begins, good.
Right. This is the Hebrew word for right him on.
That's right. Right on, man. Yes. Let's do this. I mean, you can imagine as soon as there's been war between them, and you know, I'm sure David's wondering, how is this all gonna happen? How am I gonna be king over all Israel? He doesn't want all the bloodshed associated with conquering the northern kingdom. That's just gonna lead to bitterness. So now God has basically put this in his lap. So he says, great, I will make a covenant with you. But he has one condition. And this one condition gets us back to David's wives that I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast. He says, I've got one, not a request, but a demand. Here's my one demand, that you're not going to see my face unless you first bring Michal, the daughter of Saul, when you come to see me. Now, even in the language of see my face, we hear David speaking regally. If you look at that particular idiomatic phrase from almost the beginning of Scripture throughout the rest of the Old Testament, to see someone's face is, in most cases, an idiom that means to see the face of a king. Or it could be used to see the face of God. For instance, when when Moses wants to see God's glories, he says, you shall not see my face. You shall not see the face of the king, but you're going to see my back. And that's what David is saying here. You're not going to see my kingly face. You're not going to come into my regal presence unless this happens. You got to first bring me Michal, the daughter of Saul, when you come to see me.
Do you think this is also a political move by David, where he thinks that being married to Saul's daughter is going to help anybody who thinks... You know, if you have a bunch of people that are like, well, it's really Saul's family. Perhaps being married to Saul's daughter, having her around, is a good thing. Because I mean, David's got all these other wives. I'm having a hard time believing that it's like I've spent all of this time just grieving the loss of Michal. I mean, she's married to a different guy.
Yeah. Right. Oh, I. We've seen multiple times that David is he's a multifaceted character. And as you mentioned, I think maybe in the last episode, you know, two things can be true at once. You know, he might honestly miss her. But at the same time, he also knows that, man, you know, if I'm going to be Saul's heir, what a great opportunity to say, well, I'm also his son-in-law.
Yeah.
You know, this puts me right in the family.
Yeah, and I like that the demand is also going to bring up exactly what he had to do to make her his wife. He's just wanted to remind people, look, this wedding arrangement did not come easy.
Yeah, it required some hunting.
Yes.
and some gathering. So now the next verse, I had not noticed this until I was preparing this morning. Kind of interesting language. So it doesn't say that Abner sent messengers to Ish-bosheth saying, you need to give David his wife back. It says David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth. So this is king to king saying, here's what you need to do. So I between the lines, we know, just because of the preceding narrative, that Abner was the one who really made this happen. But it is interesting, the language it used. So David sent messengers to Ishbosheth and Saul's son and said, give me my wife, Michal. And here's what you were talking about. To whom I was betrothed for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. The most unique, it's not a dowry, but I don't know what you, the most unique way to win a bride, perhaps in the history of humanity.
It's definitely different than, you know, Jacob trying to get some wives from Laban.
Working
or anything.
7 years.
It's different than that.
So verse 15 says that Ishbosheth complied. It says he sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, the son of Laish. Now, we don't know anything about this guy.
Bummer, man.
The next verse. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I was going to say the next verse, man, my heart goes out to this guy. It's an emotional scene. It says in verse 16, so this is after they, you know, sent to take her away, that their husband went with her and he's weeping as he goes along. And he follows her as far as this place called Bahurim. And then Abner, I guess he gets tired of this, turns around and says, go, return. So he went back. But man, that's a short description, but it's a pretty moving scene. So yeah, I mean, how could your heart not go out to this poor guy? You know, he's obviously loves her. They're married. If you remember the story, Saul took her away from David, even though there's no precedent for that in biblical law, but he did. He's the king, I guess he did what he wanted, but he took her away from David, and David was fleeing from Saul in the wilderness, and he gives her to this other guy. And this other guy loved her. And so he's following along, I guess, until Abner decides he's going to threaten him if he doesn't turn back. You know, it's a possibly a foreshadowing of problems that are going to haunt David later on when he takes a wife away from the guy. You know, this is a little bit different situation, granted, but this could not have been received well, I would think, by the people who were really devoted to Saul. Oh, so you've got six wives, but you're going to take Michal away from this guy? And it's like, you don't have enough wives already? But so possibly we see kind of a foreshadowing of what David is to engage in a much more sinister way later on. Anyway, that scenario happens. Verse 17, we pick up the story of Abner. Abner had a consultation with the elders of Israel. So he's making his moves. He's going and he's going to talk with various groups of people. So he first goes to elders of Israel and he says, look, in times past, you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then, do it. For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people Israel from the hand of the Philistines and from the hand of all their enemies. And then he went and he spoke to the people of Benjamin. And then it picks up the story with him going to see David in Hebron. Now, I was reflecting on his words. Just I don't know if this is Abner just kind of making up stuff.
Yeah, I was about to say, I don't recall God saying these exact words. This isn't like a quote. I mean, it's a quote. It's in quotations in the text, but he's not saying, thus said, you know, the prophet Samuel or something like that. Mm-hmm. He's just saying, this is what it is. It's almost like he's telling people, you know what God has said about David, and everyone there listening is like, yeah, okay. Like you're telling people something that they're supposed to know. No one wants to be like, who said that?
Yeah. Do you have a scripture? You have a chapter and verse on that?
Yeah.
Well, not just that, but even the preceding verse where he says, you know, all those times you were wanting David to be king over you. And I'm thinking, I don't really remember that happening either.
No, this guy, Abner, is a very persuasive guy by like putting thoughts in your head that, you know, he's like, listen, I know, like, for a long time you guys have wanted this, and somehow the people are like, I guess
come to, now that you say it, I guess we did. I guess we did really want,
just convince
really
you of your own, of things you don't, that you don't think.
Or maybe Abner's just like, he's so powerful that people are like, yeah that's what we thought. Whatever you say, Abner, we'll agree with you. But Anyway, he is persuasive.
Yeah, I mean, he was confident about his ability to do this from the jump. I mean, he is like, I'll give you the kingdom if you want. I mean, because I can do that. And so he had no doubt that he could accomplish this.
Yeah, Abner was not lacking in confidence. That is for sure. So he kind of, you know, he greases the wheels up in the northern kingdom, and then says he goes to Hebron, where David's at. And all seemed good to Israel and to the whole house of Benjamin. And then he takes his 20 guys, and they go to Hebron to David. And of course, David's, you know, he's very happy that Abner shows up. They make this feast, and not just a feast for David and for Abner, but for everybody who's there. Now, Joab, this is very important. Joab is not there. So Joab, David's military leader, is absent. Remember, Joab is David's nephew, the son of David's sister. So he's probably out, you know, making a raid or something like that. So he's not there. And that becomes crucial to the story. Because if you remember from the previous chapter, Abner had been chased by Joab's brother Azahel. And when Azahel wouldn't give up the chase, Abner stopped, shoved his spear backward, and killed Joab's brother. All right. So you got this family dynamic and family feud is kind of hovering in the background here.
Yeah, and this is going to color exactly how Joab views Abner. I mean, we're going to get there, but Joab's got a couple of reasons to not want Abner around. One is that he killed his brother, and so that's mm-hmm. usually not someone you want around. And also, they're both military leaders, and Abner seems like the kind of guy that is not just a military leader, but that is extremely well-liked, has a ton of influence. You know, so I'm sure Joab's like, this is a little bit of a threat to my position. I mean, the David's mm-hmm. making covenants with this dude. Like, that's like the worst person for you to have coming for your job is the guy that killed your brother. I mean, so this is going to be a tense situation.
Yeah, there could not be a worse person from Joab's perspective to bring over this whole kingdom to David. It's like the last person that he would ever want to be working with or threatened by, because of all those reasons you just mentioned. So anyway, that's going to become important in a few more verses. But first of all, what happens between David and Abner? Well, they have the feast, and Abner said to David, more or less, let me go. You know, we've settled everything. Let me arise and go, and I'll gather all Israel to my lord the king. So he's referring to David as a king here. And that they may make a covenant with you, and that you may be king over all that your soul desires. So once more, Abner is promising what no doubt he is going to be able to deliver. And this is music to David's ears. This is, you know, it's been war for years, and David is not the kind of king who's going to want to go in, conquer the northern kingdom, and impose himself over the people of who were following Saul. He knows that's going to be a recipe for disaster. So once this has happened, I mean, it seems as if at this point of the story, this is everything is falling into place. Yeah. Everything is perfect. Nothing could have been better for David than this to happen. So now there's an ominous phrase, or maybe ominous isn't the best word, but there's a significant phrase that occurs three times in verse 21, 22, and 23. And it's that he went in peace, or he had gone in peace. And in the Hebrew, it's the exact same thing all three times. V'yelech b'shalom, v'yelech b'shalom, v'yelech b'shalom, meaning he went in shalom. He went in peace. This is it's repeated three times to make sure that we don't miss this. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. So everything's good. Verse 22, the servants of David and Joab come in from a raid. So like I mentioned earlier, they had been out, you know, doing what David used to do. They brought a whole bunch of spoil back with them. Now, Abner was not with David in Hebron at this point because he'd already gone away. And he had gone in peace once more. Same phrase, verse 22. So Joab and his army, they get back, and somebody, it says they, told Joab, or it was told to Joab. So we don't know who told him this, but somebody reported what had happened. And here's what they said. Abner came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he's gone in peace. So three times, this is accented.
And this is Joab, this is their way of just saying he was here, and then David sent him away, but didn't send him away in a, you need to leave, or I'm going to kill you. Send him away. Like, they're all, he sent him away, but they're good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is like a almost technical language. It didn't mean to like everything, you know, was they made the agreement or whatever. This is like kind of an official, everything was good. They made the covenant. They had the feast. Everything was settled. Everything was shalom. Everything was just peaceful as it should be between them. But Joab, here's what Joab says when he hears about this. He comes to the king and he says, what have you done? Look, Abner came to you. Why then have you sent him away? And I'm reading the New American Standard here. And he is already gone. Now, what's important, if you were looking at this in the Hebrew, you'd see three times, V'yelech bo shalom, V'yelech bo shalom, V'yelech bo shalom, and he went away in peace. Now, when Joab gets back, he says not V'yelech bo shalom, but V'yelech halok. Halok can be translated, he's already gone. But what's interesting is that sometimes that is used as a synonym for dead. It's almost there's almost a hint here. Joab doesn't say he's gone away in peace. He's already gone, with, especially from what we know happens afterward, with a kind of an ominous threat that's attached to that. Like, yeah, he's a goner. We might translate it in English. He went away and he is a goner. So, and then he goes on to say, you know, he's talking to David, you know Abner, the son of Ner. The reason he came was to deceive you and to learn of your going out and your coming in and to find out all that you're doing. I think we've talked about before how to go out and to come in is a idiomatic Hebrew phrase that's often connected with military activity. So you go out and you wage war, you go out and you make a raid, then you come back. So he came to check out, more or less, to spy on what you're doing.
Now this, of course, we know is not true. Even though Joab says, you know, this is what happened. He obviously is not as persuasive as Abner. When Abner says, you know, something that you don't know, you start to think that you know it. Joab, not so much, because this is not true and David doesn't think it's true.
Yeah. Yeah. And you, well, of course, if you're Joab, you probably would interpret every single action of Abner negatively.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not only did he kill your brother, and so you've got revenge on your mind, but he is also the most powerful military leader almost in the history of Israel. So that's the way he responds. Now, David, interestingly, does not respond. At least if he did, we're not told how David responded to Joab when he says this. There's just kind of a break in the conversation. That's how it ends. Now, verse 26 says that Joab, he decided he would act unilaterally. So as soon as he leaves David, he sent some messengers. He's like, hey, I want you to go and find Abner. Evidently, he was still on his way back. So they brought him back from this place called the Well of Sirah. And David did not know about it. Now, this chapter goes to pains to make sure that we know that David had absolutely nothing to do with what's about to transpire. David is completely innocent here.
Yeah, and David was probably used, or his name was used. Joab's going to send messengers to tell him to come back. And it doesn't seem like they went and captured him. Like, they just said to come back. And so they probably said, you need to come back. David wants you to come back.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a bold move if you're Joab, because I don't think kings like it when you do that sort of thing.
No, it's the equivalent of using the Lord's name in vain, right?
Yeah. You're
using pinning a letter on the president's letterhead or something. You're asking for trouble. Well, what happens? We're told very, very briefly, verse 27, what transpired. Abner comes back. He comes to Hebron. Now, side note here, Hebron is one of the cities of refuge. So Hebron is one of those places to which you flee if you have accidentally killed someone. So that adds a kind of another layer to what's about to happen here. Hebron is supposed to be a neutral space, in other words, where people are safe, where they can actually seek refuge if they've killed someone. So Abner goes back to Hebron. Joab takes him aside into the middle of the gate to speak with him privately. So Joab is acting kind of like, hey, you know, we need to maybe talk about some military matters or whatever it might be. He's taking him aside. Listen, let me bend your ear for a minute. Let me talk to you about something. And when he gets him in there, it says that he struck him in the belly so that he died on account of the blood of Azahel, his brother. So this is kind of a tit for tat murder, revenge murder, because Azahel, Joab's brother, was killed when Abner used his spear, thrust it backward, and it hit him in the belly. And so probably Joab thinks this is a rightful way to seek his revenge. But of course it's cowardly. I mean, this is there's nothing that's bold about this, or courageous, or warrior-like. This is nothing more than an assassination.
Yeah, and it probably tells you that Joab doesn't necessarily think that he can maybe kill Abner if he just faces him. If he just, you know, says, "Hey, come over here," and then says, "You and I are about to do this right now in front of everybody."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Apparently, Joab does not. Yeah. Apparently, Joab doesn't think that will end well for him.
Yeah. So I mean, that particular episode tells you a lot about Joab. We'll see Joab's story unravel as we go through the rest of 2 Samuel and into the book of 1 Kings. But he kills him, it says, on account of the blood of Azahel, his brother. So he's seeking revenge, doing the same thing that we discussed, I believe, last time, where you have this Goel Hadan, this redeemer of blood, where he's out to seek vengeance for the death of his brother. But of course, this just unravels. David hears about it, and he says, "I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever on the account of the blood of Abner, the son of Ner." And then he issues this fivefold curse on the house of Joab. So David's not just content to say, "Listen, I had nothing to do with this." He actually curses the house of Joab, who is his nephew. So he's cursing somebody who's a part of his own family. He says, "May it fall on the head of Joab," probably meaning the blood guilt. "May the blood guilt fall on the head of Joab and all his father's house. And may there not fail from the house of Joab one who has a discharge, or who is a leper, who takes hold of a spindle, or who falls by the sword, or who lacks bread." So he's kind of picking from various curses that could be uttered against someone. And we'll see, as we're almost out of time now, but we'll see how this kind of unfolds in the rest of the chapter. But you know, I when I was going through this, I was reminded of one of my favorite quotes by Robert Capon, and listeners maybe have come across this too. But I often think of this quote when something like this happens in the scriptures. The quote is this: "What has really made a mess of our world? Grace, forgiveness, turning the other cheek, or is it guilt, punishment, vengeance, and retribution?" And this is just a classic case of this, because this is going to, I mean, the chance that David had here of uniting the kingdom under the activity of Abner has just been destroyed. And not just destroyed, but now you have, you know, people are going to think David was behind this, and you have a man murdered, and now you're going to, you know, you kill my family member, I kill yours. It's going to kind of go back and forth and escalate, all because someone was seeking vengeance, seeking retribution. And man, don't we see this all over the scriptures and all over, I mean, our lives as well today, that almost every single time you've got a mess in the world, it's not related to grace or forgiveness or turn to the other cheek, but it's because of somebody seeking vengeance or guilt or punishment or retribution.
Yeah. And this is too, I mean, this isn't like Abner had killed his brother in this sort of cowardly way. As we talked about that episode, this is easy to paint as self-defense. I mean, Abner was trying to get away from him, and eventually somebody was going to have to die. But he was not the one, he wasn't chasing down his brother. And so the whole thing is cowardly. You have to think that if Joab were not David's nephew, that there's no chance that he survives this.
No. I mean, in fact, I'm kind of surprised that David does not have him cut down as a result of this. And I don't know exactly why, but David does everything to make sure that everybody knows. I mean, he kind of stages a media event, you might say, afterward. We'll see that next episode. But they have, you know, he chants a lament. They have a funeral. He makes Joab put on sackcloth and walk behind the casket, more or less. So David wants to make sure that, listen, I had zero to do with this. I was completely opposed to it. This is all Joab's doing. Now, why did he not take Joab out? You know, I suppose eventually that's going to happen. He's going to let kind of not nature take its course, but the blood guilt take its course over time.
Yeah, but yeah, you would have to assume that if this wasn't part of his family, I don't think there's no chance that you survived this.
No, absolutely not. Because like I said, this was a perfectly wrapped present that was placed into David's lap. That wasn't just good for David; it's good for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, North, South, everybody involved. So many lives would have been saved, but because of this one act of vengeance, all of that was ruined. And so it's going to take some more time before the kingdom is able to unite under David.
And that is it, man. We are much out of time. We are way out of time. And so we will pick it back up. David, pro lamenter that he is going to spin out another good one. It makes Abner seem like pretty great guy. Especially when you're writing songs about the general of your enemy. It's something, man. So we'll check that out next week.
All right. See you then.